was now the second city of the world's greatest empire. Once, this is where you came to watch concerts or plays or exhibition snooker tournaments. These days, its function has fossilised somewhat, but it still opens to the public for craft fairs and the odd special exhibition, and every August, the famous floor with its 30,000 priceless mint and tiles is uncovered for general public consumption. Liverpool has a ton of stuff to be proud of, but it has one undeniable da-da moment, one bit of sleight of hand that never fails to impress. And that is the moment when the pedestrianised every town falls away behind you and the drag down from Derby Square and James Street suddenly, inexplicably, becomes the finest waterfront in Britain, the Liverpool Pierhead. Former poet laureate John Masefield said, "The Thames is a wretched river after the Mersey, and the ships are not like Liverpool ships, and the docks are barren of beauty. It is a beastly hole after Liverpool, for Liverpool is the town of my heart, and I would rather sail a mudflat there than command a clipper out of London." The famed highlight of the pierhead is the Three Graces, the trio of monumental buildings comprising the Royal Liver Building, the Cunard Building and the Port of Liverpool Building. There was going to be a fourth, but there isn't now. It's all been a bit of an embarrassment, really. There were certainly some strong opinions expressed on the walls of the Liverpool Vision offices. Essentially, what happened is that Liverpool Vision ran a competition to design a fourth grace, and something called The Cloud by Nicholas Alsop was chosen. We will never see it now as intended, but from the artist's impression I glanced at, it looked a bit like the rings of Saturn done in melting Lego. Anyway, what no one thought to take into account is that the pierhead is a World Heritage Site, and the mandarins of that scheme flatly refused permission for The Cloud on the grounds that it was too big and not in keeping. This has polarised the locals into traditionalists, who are secretly quite pleased, and a surprising number of modernists, who have blamed Victorian theme parking and small-mindedness. As one critic has wailed in the magazine Downtown Liverpool, "Why did we let height restrictions kill this project? Are we Milton Keynes or Manhattan?" The answer is quite obviously Manhattan. As my friend the writer Andrew Harrison put it to me, Liverpool is the easternmost city of the United States. Think about it. A bustling Atlantic seaport full of off-duty sailors, Irish, Chinese, Catholics, black marketeers and the like. A huge, diverse working-class population. He's right. After Liverpool, its next stop New York, and the city's culture has always reflected that. From its markedly transatlantic street speech and slick slang, to the Youngman's long-standing predilection for blues, black music, R&B and rock and roll, brought home by sailors, the Cunard Yanks, as presents for siblings and sweethearts. Whereas London looks towards Europe, wants to be more stylish than Milan, Paris or Rome, Liverpool emulates the brash, wisecracking, melting pot mentality of the Big Apple. If you want to see and feel just how American Liverpool is, though, you have to see it from the water. The ferry cruises downriver to avoid the passing cargo boats before heading straight across the Mersey to Seacombe. Amazingly, ferry boats have done this for 800 years, since 1150, when the monks of Birkenhead rowed passengers by hand across the river. Back then, the Mersey was far more treacherous and the crossing extremely hazardous, taking at least 2 hours. By the 1500s, the ferries had acquired the very latest in modern technology, namely sails and rigging, and raced across in an hour and a half. After risking hypothermia on the promenade deck, I go to the cafe for a reviving Kenko. "How long does the round trip take?" I ask the girl behind the counter. She frowns sweetly. "Oh, I don't really know. I suppose I should, shouldn't I?" she giggles, as if I'd asked her the circumference of Neptune. 20 minutes of chilly, choppy river-going later, you're docking, with maximum clanking and shouting at Seacombe, gateway to Birkenhead, which from here looks just like Trumpton. These days there are just 3 stops on the ferry, but in the Victorian steam heyday, boats buzzed between Birkenhead and Woodside, Tranmere, Rock Ferry, New Ferry, Bromborough, Eastham, Wallasey, Seacombe, Egremont and New Brighton. After Birkenhead, the ship heads upriver, past the Camel Ledge shipyards and out towards Eastham, where the Manchester Ship Canal begins. If you fancy a long day afloat, it's 6 hours to Salford and a bus brings you back to Liverpool. and the Tranmere oil refinery, where the pipeline runs to Stanlow. Last time I came that way, I took the train under the river to meet Half Man, Half Biscuit, the world's leading pop satirists and Tranmere Rovers fans. This time, though, I'm trying to get the circulation back in my hands and wishing that the cafe sold whiskey to go in this Kenko. I remember the wry words of Liverpool striker John Aldridge commenting on the intense heat in Florida for the 1994 World Cup. It gets like this in Liverpool when you're on the ferry and the sun reflects off the Mersey. You could almost forget the cold that's now deep in your marrow, though, when the ferry swings around in a great loop and begins its return to the pier head. First, the city's two cathedrals come into view through the grey murk, a Protestant one designed by a Catholic and a Catholic one designed by a Protestant, a piece of 60s concrete psychedelia known locally as Paddy's Wigwam. Then, as you approach the pier head, Liverpool suddenly turns it on in a dazzling display that has everything to do with Manhattan and nothing to do with Milton Keynes. From here, you can see that though Liverpool is twinned with Odessa, Dublin, Cologne and others, its real twin is New York. You wonder if the rough guide writer could have possibly been so slighting and pitying if they'd seen Liverpool from the prow of the ferry. There cannot be anywhere else like this in England. The onboard commentary on the tourist ferry draws our attention skywards to the top of the Liver building and the two Liver birds in their lofty and solitary splendour. They can never mate as they have their backs to each other. She looks out to sea for the returning sailor. He looks towards the city to see if the pubs are open. The ancient legend, which stretches back a barely believable, 80 years, states that if the birds should ever leave, then all the city will crumble and disappear. I doubt very much that this will happen, since, unlike the similarly significant ravens at the Tower of London, the liver birds are made of metal and nailed to the top of the building. I suppose it's possible a scally might rob them and sell them for scrap in Bootle. Just as we're about to disembark and the crew start to do manly, maritime-ish things with chains and gangplanks, a fellow passenger sidles up to me, a middle-aged man in a trench coat and flamboyant trilby. I make the mistake of catching his eye, and am treated to a verbal assault that is both quintessentially Scouse in its speed and prolixity, and quite mad, beginning as a kind of rhapsody of complaint against the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company, and swelling impressively to a symphony of meaningless rage. I notice a wide-eyed look of pity in the eyes of the ferrymen. They have clearly been privy to this wide-ranging stream of consciousness tirade many times before. In defiance of safety instructions, as soon as the gangplank is down, I leap for the jetty, and I'm off, up the steep ramp, en route to the Albert Dock. The Albert Dock was an early jewel of Liverpool's civic regeneration, one of the world's first enclosed docks, and with the highest density of Grade 1 listed buildings in England, you can only marvel that at one point in the 1980s, the council were going to drain it, flatten it, and make it into a multi-storey car park. Nowadays, the Albert Dock is a curious mixture of tat and art. On the quality side, there's Tate Liverpool. Impressive, ultra-modern, all Rothko poster books and carob cake in the cafe. There's the Maritime Museum. By the way, in place of the Fourth Grace, they're going to build a new museum on the pierhead because evidently Liverpool thinks you can never have too many museums. There's Baby Cream, an offshoot of the city's hugely successful super club, Cream, where you can sip a Mai Tai on an uncomfortable tan leather pouf and hope Steven Gerrard pops in. There is the splendid launch point of the Yellow Duck Marine, a canary-coloured amphibious vehicle that churns and circles about in the dock for a while before, in an ooh-ah coup de théâtre loved by kids of all ages, actually rising up out of the water in a sheet of spray and taking to the streets of Liverpool. The sheer fun of the enterprise is inversely proportional to the ferocious and very un-Scouse surliness of the girl in the ticket office, who seemed to be getting divorced over the phone and regarded me as an unwelcome interruption. There's a ripe chunk of cheesiness, though. Gift shops selling those souvenirs you might buy if you were very drunk or were a Shoreditch ironist. Tea towels emblazoned with Scouse glossaries, ashtrays, posters and wristbands bearing insulting messages about whichever football team you don't support. Tucked away at the far end of the Albert Dock from Tate Liverpool is an underground exhibition that celebrates Liverpool's real cultural contribution to the world. You wondered when I'd get round to it, didn't you? Yes, Salzburg has Mozart, Stratford has Shakespeare, Liverpool, well, it has Atomic Kitten, The Swinging Blue Jeans, Sonia, Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Echo and the Bunnymen, and one day they may name airports after them. Until then, though, as far as pop music goes, this city is very keen on reminding you that it's Liverpool 4, the rest of the world, nil. If your city had produced one of human civilization's most important cultural forces ever, a group of individuals who in their global significance almost transcended the bounds of the human, who became demigods responsible for changing not only the sound of a planet's music and the shape of its culture, but the look and structure of its societies, then you could be forgiven for making a bit of a fuss about it. Yet you can't help thinking that Liverpool does go on a bit about the Beatles. There are plenty of ordinary Scousers who find the cult of the Fabs embarrassing, hopelessly backward-looking and recherché. The City Fathers have no such reservations. If you arrive by plane, lucky you, trills the City Guide, you deplane at John Lennon International Airport, with its motto of, "Above us, only sky," taken from the glutinous anthem Imagine by the airport's dedicatee. Frankly, I'd have preferred nothing to kill or die for and no religion too. Now visit our fabulous duty-free shopping area. There's a statue of Lennon in Arrivals based on the Abbey Road cover. Taken out of context, it looks like he's storming out of somewhere in a huff. This is kind of appropriate, I feel, as rather than the sainted holy man that he's now absurdly regarded as, Lennon was actually a rather sour personality, short-tempered, sulky and often cruel. I wonder if he'd have turned up for the renaming ceremony. I think he would have. I can just see him now, pulling the little curtains to one side and doing his hilarious Mong face. Liverpool's Beatle heritage industry embraces the tacky and the thoughtful simultaneously, sentimental and savvy as only Liverpool can be. Matthew Street, site of the famous Cavern Club, is now heart of the Cavern Quarter, and in the Cavern Walk Shopping Centre, incongruously alongside the Vivian Westwood shop, you will find, from me to you, the Beatles Store. Store, not shop. You can see who it's aimed at. Here, as you might think, you can find all manner of Beatle memorabilia, from a Doug Millings Nehru jacket to a Yellow Submarine duvet cover. Alongside all this, though, is the kind of general rock tat you find in Carnaby Street. Motorhead bullet belts, Led Zeppelin t-shirts. I couldn't for the life of me see why. Surely there can't be any shortage of Hard Day's 90s, or We Can Work It Out calculators. The store is owned by Gary Blaine, who's run it for 5 years. He told me this, having stopped me on the way out of Cavern Walks and asking me why I was making notes in his shop. Having assured Gary that I wasn't from the Department of Fair Trading or engaged in Beatle-related industrial espionage, he became extremely personable and gave me a free map. Outside there's an Abbey Road pub and another called the John Lennon, although for authenticity you should sip a bottle of light ale in the grapes, just as the underage Beatles did before they discovered Scotch and Coke. But why shouldn't Liverpool boast about the Beatles? Without the Beatles, there are no pop groups. In fact, no pop music in the modern sense of the word. This isn't some bunch of lad rockers going through the moves and the motions. No, these are the lads who invented the moves and the motions. So let Liverpool celebrate its most famous sons. The Beatles story, just follow the sound of the endless loop of Beatles songs from the south end of Albert Dock, tries hard to do this authoritatively, and with some grated entertainment cheese liberally sprinkled on top. Again, I can't help wishing that they'd brainstormed a little longer at the slogans meeting. Let me take you down implies that you're going to find it depressing, and to be truthful, the Lennon and Harrison tributes aren't chucklesome, and getting better all the time makes it sound as if it was rubbish when it started. You won't be shortchanging the Beatles story if you're in and out in 40 minutes. If you have a couple of hours, though, go on the Magical Mystery Tour, a trip on a coach straight from that misunderstood film, which takes in most Beatle-related Liverpool landmarks. Beatles music plays throughout, naturally, and Japanese tourists sing along winningly all the way. The tour stops at all the places you'd expect, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields, even the road where Lennon's mum Julia was knocked down and killed. But the latest attractions are the National Trust properties at 20 Forthlyn Road and the Mendips, childhood homes of one Paul McCartney and John Lennon, respectively. There was a great deal of sniggering about the National Trust buying what, in the case of Forthlyn Road, amounts to a mass-produced council house, an intermediate-type standard Building 5 built in 1952 for little more than a grand, under the layers of modernisation introduced by a well-meaning house-proud tenants down the years, the Trust were excited about finding the original lino in the young Paul's bedroom. At the time of purchase, this prompted yet more sniggering from those who believe that the upkeep of ugly, ostentatious, stately homes in Surrey and Gloucester is the correct use of National Trust money and not council houses in Liverpool. Mindful of the fact that my soapbox is never far away at moments like this, I'll just say that even if 20 Forthlyn Road were merely an example of how upper working class families lived in the years after the war, modest, much-loved homes for ordinary people viewing the future with trepidation and hope, it would be worth preserving. But it isn't just that, of course. This is where Paul and John wrote the early Beatles classics, eyeball to eyeball, on the sofa, while Paul's dad was out at work, Paul and John breaking off for fried egg sandwiches and crafty woodbines. The grandiose country piles and family seats of our various Lord and Lady Mucks pale into insignificance next to this compact wee house. From this stolid, mildly frumpy little room, the North revolutionised the known world. When you're sated with the Beatles, remember that Liverpool, according to Paul de Noyer's excellent book Wondrous Place, has always made more music than most cities and made it more passionately because it was in the personality of Liverpool to do so. And Liverpool has the personality it has because it is a seaport. Liverpool only exists because it is a seaport. Its virtues and its vices, its accent and attitude, its insularity and its open-mindedness are all derived from that primary fact. Interestingly, when Daniel Defoe was eulogising the pool in the 1720s, he made reference to the ships that sailed from there to Norway, the Baltic and Hamburg. Three and a bit centuries later, it was the musical trade between Liverpool and Hamburg that made the Beatles a seaworthy crew, ready to conquer the world. Liverpool's music has always been joyous, skittish, heady and psychedelic, while, say, Manchester's has usually been more dour, cool and narcotic. At the end of the 70s, the Cavern blossomed again, this time as Eric's, centre of a kaleidoscopic scene where The Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen, Wah Heat, Pink Military, The Icicle Works and more fused punk attitude with hippie beatitudes to produce a new northern psychedelia. Ever since Macca went upstairs to have a smoke and then went off into a dream in A Day in the Life, Scousers have loved a bit of blow. In the 80s, the city's lads created their own version of the football casual, the Scally, a roguish, whippet-thin chancer dressed in tachini and Lacoste. Add a mellowing joint, or 10, and he becomes the Retro Scally, or Cosmic Scouser. I first came across this strange, engaging sect when I was working in Skem. While the NME would tell them on a weekly basis that they ought to be listening to Public Enemy, Pop Will Eat Itself, or Einstürzen der Neubauten, the Retro Scallies existed in an aromatic world of their own making, built on their older brothers' record collections, escaping from the privations of Thatcher's Britain not through officially sanctioned indie music or American hip-hop, but through The Floyd, Genesis, Frank Zappa and late-period Beatles. I would spend lunchtimes in the pub with them, arguing the relative merits of Atom Heart Mother and The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, and haggling to buy the college's video player back via the town's black market after its weekly theft. In case that sounds like I'm condoning criminality, let's just say that a certain low level of nefarious activity was regarded as normal. After all, if crooks in good suits in London could line their pockets flogging off gas, water and railways that actually belonged to me, why shouldn't a scally make the odd tenner selling me my own video back from time to time? That said, though, Liverpool isn't red in the way Manchester is red. The socialism that created the Labour Party has no history here as it does in Manchester, or for that matter Sheffield. Liverpool was never that kind of industrial city with a stable, unionised workforce. Dock labour was casualised until the 1960s and wasn't regarded as a job for life, complete with a pension and rights. The kind of socialism that grows out of religious nonconformism barely existed in this city with a large Catholic population. I doubt very much if in Manchester or Sheffield, with their strong, moralistic, conventional socialism, something as mad as the militant tendency could ever have taken over as they did here. A mafiosi who talked Marx, but who looked like a cabal of wide boys in flash suits on the make, the ultimate Thatcherites. Persistent rumour has it that as the tide turned and Kinnock began to gain the upper hand over militant, many a member of Derek Hatton's notorious security squad, a private army in all but name, moved effortlessly into the city's new burgeoning dance music scene. Liverpool was slow to pick up on house and dance music in the 90s, being, as Andrew Harrison puts it, suspicious of any trend they hadn't started themselves. But when they did embrace it, they did so with gusto and a superhuman appetite for excess. Liverpool invented the super club, and the city's club scene is still riotously fertile and very different from the southern version. The accent in Liverpool is not on untouchable cool, but on irrepressible fun. Listen to Liverpool Girl by Ian McNab for a lovely, cheeky, affectionate portrait of the city's young womanhood, who looks exactly like her mother, though strangely nothing like her brother, and wears her silver jeans going out to cream, dancing under laser beams. But is that Liverpool Girl northern? I think so, but then Wiston Hospital notwithstanding, I'm not really a Scouser. I ask a real one, a craggy middle-aged chap with a firm handshake who's shifting barrels outside one of the Beatle theme pubs on Matthew Street. I'm a northerner, yeah, definitely, and Liverpool is the north. But a lot of Scousers don't reckon it is. When Liverpool does deign to call itself northern, it assumes, by natural right, that it is the capital of the north. But it has a rival. There is another power in the northwest, Moscow to Liverpool's New York, Pyongyang to its Seoul, Minas Morgul to its Minas Tirith. A mortal enemy glowering from across the Lancashire Plain, along the asphalt ribbon of the M62. It rises in the east, curtained with rain, swearing, walking like a monkey and wearing a beanie hat. The rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester is not like the rivalry between, say, Edinburgh and Glasgow, based on a philosophic and cultural gap between two proud cities whose very difference and diversity is somehow useful and fruitful. It doesn't actually make sense to think of what goes down between the Scousers and the Manx as a rivalry at all. It's a vendetta, a blood feud that's Sicilian in its intensity. No player has been transferred between the two football clubs since Phil Chisnall moved from United to Liverpool in 1964. Also, the malice and ill will borne by fans of Liverpool and Manchester United football teams outweighs by far that felt by either team for their traditional rivals across the city, Everton and Manchester City. Just check the priorities evident in this charming ditty sung by Manchester United Stretford End supporters to the tune of Oh My Darling Clementine. Build a bonfire, put the Scousers on the top, put Man City on the bottom, and we'll burn the fucking lot. The sickest, thickest sections of both sets of supporters take pleasure in rubbing salt in either city's rawest wounds, the 1989 Hillsborough tragedy and the Munich air crash of 1958. Some Liverpool fans sing Always Check on the Runway for Ice, to the horribly jaunty tune of Always Look on the Bright Side of Life while doing childish airplane impressions. United's idiot rump chant, You Should Have All Died at Hillsborough, to the lilting melody of Guantanamera, and If It Wasn't for the Scousers We Could Stand. I've been amongst otherwise reasonable people who, after a drink or two and in the red fog of the moment, have sung these songs. That tells you a lot about just how crazy some people can get around football, and even about how deep the rifts and the old scores go between the Scousers and the Manx. They go right back to what ex-Manchester United boss Ron Atkinson used to call early doors, the kick-off of British economic might, the Industrial Revolution. As smoke and noise and seismic change shook the whole of Northern England, Manchester and Liverpool were already stoking the fires of their vituperative feud from a mere 35 miles distance. Liverpool became resentful of Manchester's staggeringly swift civic rise. It mushroomed in size from what Defoe patronisingly called the greatest mere village in the 1700s to a metropolis of 100,000 people by 1812 and the world's first industrial city. Its wealth was based largely on cotton, the raw materials of Manchester's booming textile mills. As you'll know if you've spent any time around these parts, cotton fields are at a premium in Chorley. Manchester's cotton therefore had to be imported from the plantations and the slave estates of America's Deep South. And after its journey across the Atlantic, how did it get to Manchester? Resolutely and distantly inland? Via Liverpool, of course, which, as we've seen, opens its blousy arms wide to transatlantic travellers of every kind. Thus, Liverpool spied a chance to get its own back on uppity Manchester. Holding the trump card of that sea access, it imposed a tax on US cotton imports. But Manchester retaliated in audacious and spectacular style by constructing a broad, artificial waterway pretty much parallel to the Mersey on the Wirral bank of the river and carrying traffic from the ocean. This grandiose gesture was the Manchester Ship Canal, the civil engineering equivalent of Gary Neville running the length of the pitch to kiss his United badge in front of enraged Liverpool fans. The canal was opened in 1894, rendered Liverpool's levy redundant, and for a century made a thriving port of a landlocked city. No mean feat. In 1830, when the world's first passenger railway was built between the two cities, not even Stevenson's rocket could bring those hearts and minds together. The opening day was somewhat marred in any case by the fact that William Huskisson MP got hit by a train and killed, but even before this, many people were hostile to the enterprise and wanted it to fail. Some Liverpudlians felt that passenger traffic with Manchester, a grubby, sooty, inland town with ideas above its station, railway or otherwise, would bring the wrong sort to Liverpool. The Liverpool gentleman and the Manchester man is a 19th century distinction still preserved by some old school Liverpudlians, meaning that the inland city grew prosperous on oily blue-collar industry and manufacture, while Liverpool was a city of commerce, shipping, insurance, trade, customs and excise. At their most caricatured and embattled, the citizens' attitudes to each other might be summarised thus. Manx thinks Scousers are lazy, sentimental, smack-head thieves in tracksuits. Scousers think Manx are dour, gun-obsessed wannabe gangsters with no sense of style or humour. Guildford probably thinks both of them are pretty much right. This spring morning, I stepped down from the Pendolino high-speed train into a dazzling steel-and-glass piazza, the concourse of the newly refurbished Piccadilly station. For years, Piccadilly was a grim entree to the delights of the city, windswept and soulless, with its one real advantage being that as it lay at the end of the line, you could fall asleep with an easy conscience, and that way you passed through Stoke oblivious. Always a bonus. Then for years it was a building site, but it all appears to have been worth it. Now when your train is delayed due to failure of lineside equipment in Congleton, Piccadilly is a diverting place to kill some time. You can buy a Coldplay CD, or a Caramel Macchiato, or Heat magazine, or any of the other things that 21st century Britons do. Every time you come to Manchester these days, the skyline has changed. It's the Shanghai of the Northwest. Construction crazy, in a state of permanent restless revolution, a frenzy of hard hats and scaffolding. In 1962, Frank Kermode wrote, "The worst thing about Manchester is that it's unstoppable, like spilt beer." And it's still spreading. The Beetham Hilton Tower is the latest vaunting gesture of architectural ambition to thrust its way skyward. On the very morning I emerge from Piccadilly Station, the Daily Mirror carries an amazing picture of a construction worker, in high-visibility tabard, of course, catching 40 winks stretched out on a girder hundreds of dizzying metres above Manchester's pavements. It will be the tallest residential tower in the UK, and from the top there are views of the Pennines, the Welsh Mountains, Blackpool Tower and Liverpool's cathedrals, which it dwarfs, much to the locals' delight, of course. This new tower is more than just a very tall, partly constructed building. It's regarded by mooching Oasis wannabe and besuited branding consultant alike as a symbol of the city's resurgent virility and regional dominance. If you think those cocky Manx have only got this way in the last couple of years, think again. A century ago, folks around here were saying, puffed up with aldermanly pride, what Manchester does today, the world does tomorrow. In the late 60s, in his wonderful book, The North Country, Graham Wilson chided them on their ridiculous self-congratulation. Filmmaker Chris Lethbridge probably came closest to how I feel about the place when he wrote in 1994, "It has a compulsion to preen and show off. It is narcissistic, contrary and wayward, and yet you cannot help but love it. It is both admirable and maddening." Nowhere is this galling, charming, maddening, admirable self-belief better seen than in the city's musical culture, and in particular, in the gloriously Mancunian tale of Factory Records. When the Sex Pistols played Manchester on the 20th of July 1976, a local TV reporter called Tony Wilson was so impressed that he invited the Pistols onto his Granada TV show. There, leering and radiating menace and glamour, they played Anarchy in the UK to a generation of stunned northern teenagers. Watching in Wigan, I could feel the tectonic plates rumble as the earth shifted. Wilson himself was a man possessed. Formerly a Cambridge-educated Leonard Cohen fan who'd come back to his hometown to present the local news show, he found himself at the centre of the greatest youth cultural foment in a decade. After promoting new wave bands tirelessly and much to the chagrin of dads across the Northwest on Granada slots such as What's On and Granada Reports, more used to items on inadequate drainage provision in Levenshulme, Wilson took the step into independent gig promotion. In May 1978, in partnership with his mate and sometime actor Alan Erasmus, he began putting on bands at the distinctly insalubrious Russell Club in Hume under the name The Factory, nights recreated for Michael Winterbottom's terrific film 24-Hour Party People at sticky-carpeted city centre rival Fagin's, ironically. Those early nights have become legendary. Joy Division, Cabaret Voltaire, the Durutti Column, the Stockholm Monsters, Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark, who were scousers who looked like Leo Sayer. Factory may have been very Mancunian, but they were never parochial. The club's distinctive advertising, Russian constructivism relocated to Lancashire, was designed by Peter Saville. The first poster became the now legendary and elusive FAC 1, the first factory artefact. FAC 2 was a factory sample, an EP of music by acts who had played at the club, the Durutti Column, Joy Division, Cabaret Voltaire and comedian John Dowie. Local journalist Paul Morley wrote enthusiastically about the new venture in the NME of 2nd of December. "Send Factory Records your cassette. The Factory, Hume, Manchester. Let's all take risks this Christmas." And it was a kind of backstreet nativity. Factory Records was born under a grimy star overseen by four wise men. Wilson, Erasmus, Saville and producer Martin Hannett, partners in what would become Britain's coolest ever record label. The Factory story is a wonderfully Mancunian story, full of vanity, lunacy, obstinacy and grand gestures. There were no contracts. Factory preferred gentlemen's agreements. And as many of the bands on Factory were far from gentlemanly, they never made the money they should have. They put out the biggest selling, most influential 12-inch single of all time, New Order's Blue Monday. But because Factory wouldn't join anything as prosaic as the British Phonographic Institute, there are no platinum discs around. If there were, maybe they could have hung them in the forbiddingly severe offices they built behind the BBC on Charles Street, and which they eventually had to sell for just £500,000 when Factory collapsed, just two-thirds of the cost of Ben Kelly's interior design alone. Kelly's masterpiece, though, was the Hacienda, a nightclub built in an old yacht showroom, maybe because a yacht showroom in a landlocked city is, in itself, a quintessentially Factory notion. It was a dreamer's gesture that for a time came true. Part folie bergère, paid for by New Order's money, as they would regularly remind you with mordant Manc humour, a kind of temple to Factory's crackpot, intoxicating ideals. Factory records were not just made in the North, they were entirely, fundamentally, imminently of the North. They sounded like the North, and Manchester in particular, made into sound. Unknown Pleasures, the astonishing first Joy Division album, actually sounds like the places where it was made. Thanks to Hannett's extraordinary production, it's haunted throughout by splintering glass, industrial hums, by whooshing and clanking that sounds like traffic passing by in the rain on the Mancunian Way, or lifts ascending desolate Hume tower blocks. Factory records were crucial in the development of Madchester too, in providing it with a creative crucible in the chemical temple of the Hacienda and in giving home to the Happy Mondays, a group of street urchins and footpads from the benighted suburb of Little Alton. Streetwise, charismatic, dangerous, psychedelic, utterly unpredictable, most record labels would have been terrified of them. Wilson and Factory embraced them, even indulged them. It couldn't last, but while it did, it made Manchester the most exciting city in Britain. But Factory could cock up for England. For instance, they missed the greatest group ever to emerge from the city, and they had them on a plate. One day in the early 80s, Tony Wilson was invited round to tea by a well-known local character, one Stephen Patrick Morrissey. So I went down to his mum's house in Stretford, and he says, "I've decided to be a pop star." And I had to muffle myself. I thought, "Never in a million years, Stephen." Well, it took a lot less than that. Stephen did get himself involved with a group called The Smiths, who became the Manchester band Incarnate. Oasis may talk the talk, but The Smiths walked the walk. Like the city at its best, they had glamour and gloom, winsomeness and wit. They were magical and proletarian all at once. Morrissey had been raised on the film and stage play of Salford teen prodigy Sheila Delaney's A Taste of Honey, fabulously evocative of post-war Salford, whether it be the kids playing in the bomb sites that scarred the city for years, or Dora Bryan dancing at the legendary Ritz nightclub. 20 years later, the Smiths played their debut gig there, performing songs that often quoted liberally from Delaney's writings. She was the Morrissey of her day, striking, precocious, working class. After leaving school, she held a variety of jobs in Salford, shop assistant, clerk in a milk depot, usherette, but she burned with the zeal to write. When she was 17, she saw a Terence Rattigan play she thought so drippy and banal, she took 2 weeks off work and wrote A Taste of Honey. Produced at the Royal Court, it was a sensation. Like Moz, she gave good quote, telling an interviewer in 1959 that North Country people are shown as gormless, where in actual fact, they are very alive and cynical. The Smiths' songs drip like an evening drizzle off the moors with references to Manchester and its environs. Rushome, Strangeways, Southern Cemetery, Wally Range, the Holy Name Church. Morrissey has a video called Humorist, a wry reference to his childhood home. In an early interview, he said of his artistic self, "I am forever chained to a disused railway line in Wigan." While Thatcher, witch-like, cast the North into the outer darkness, the Smiths' songs illuminated it anew with northern lights and fireworks. We loved them for it. 2 decades on, our preciously, jealously guarded passion is an industry. In the Tourist Information Centre, right alongside 100 hillwalks around Manchester and Manchester United the Religion, you can pick up a copy of Morrissey's Manchester, the Essential Smiths Tour by Phil Gatenby. Clutching it, you can embark on your own pilgrimage, taking in a disused French restaurant that was once Crazy Face, the clothes shop where Johnny Marr worked, or the very Iron Bridge on King's Road, Morrissey's old street, under which he kissed and ended up with sore lips as he sings in the track Still Ill. Gatenby's slim, cheery volume makes official the Smiths' tourism that's actually been going on for some years now and has made some very unlikely spots into sightseeing opportunities. An early section of his little book is titled Surviving in Manchester and reads, "Book your accommodation before arriving in Manchester and go straight to your hotel. Do not walk around the centre looking for banks and shops while carrying your bags. Blend in and look local. Plan your route before leaving your room. Do not travel alone, but do not travel in too large numbers. Remember, in the winter, it starts to go dark around 4 p.m. I would hate to see Phil's book about downtown Kabul. I take a walk around a few more old haunts for old time's sake. I stroll via Dry Bar, another uber-cool factory enterprise, down to what is now, depressingly, branded the Northern Quarter, and then to lovely Affleck's Palace, an old department store converted into 3 floors of alternative retail outlets. On Saturdays in summer, we would hang out there for hours, hoping for some kind of bohemian cool to rub off on us or to meet up with pale, interesting girls. Outside Affleck's, There's a fancy mosaic that reads, "And on the sixth day, God created Manchester." This almost entirely meaningless phrase has echoed around the city since the ecstasy-popping heyday of Madchester and reflects yet again that famous Manchester attitude. Like the accent, it can grate on some. Now that it's cleaner and safer and the IRA have stopped bombing it, the city's worst fault may be that boundless capacity for self-congratulation. Pop into the city's fine art gallery on Mosley Street and make your way through the Pre-Raphaelites and the Pissarros and the Canalettos and the replica Elgin marbles. Architect Charles Berry was a devoted Hellenophile. And you'll even find a section devoted to Manchester attitude, billed as the first psychological profile of a city in an art gallery. This probably seemed like a great idea when some enthusiastic young curator in rimless Issey Miyake specs first mooted it at the departmental meeting, but it boils down to a couple of Happy Monday sleeves, some oft-quoted Morrissey, and a general sense of empty boasting. And in fact, if it stopped banging on about its football teams and its bands and its shops and its attitude, Manchester has something that it can be genuinely, enormously proud of, something that it should shout from the gallery's porticoed rooftops. Manchester changed the world's politics. From vegetarianism to feminism to trade unionism to communism, every upstart notion that ever got ideas above its station, every snotty street fighter of a radical philosophy, was fostered brawling in Manchester's streets, mills, pubs, churches and debating halls. Before it fled to London in the 1960s and became Islingtonised, the Manchester Guardian was Britain's most radical and liberal newspaper. En passant, 30 years ago, as Nick Cohen records in Cruel Britannia, one-third of journalists were based outside London. Now 90% of reporters work in the capital. Lydia Becker, the daughter of a Chadderton chemical works owner, pioneered the notion of votes for women with her National Society for Women's Suffrage, a movement later radicalised and turned into a potent political agency by another Manchester family, the Pankhursts. The TUC first met here in 1868. Vegetarianism in the Western world began in Salford in 1809, when the Reverend William Cowherd persuaded his congregation to give up meat, and the concept swept Manchester. There were more vegetarian restaurants in the 1880s than today. The greatest military and economic superpower the world has ever known spent half a century sweating nervously, armed to the teeth and generally terrified of an idea born in Manchester, namely communism. Now that's attitude. Guided by the Guardian article I'm clutching, I'm in search of Manchester's blood-red, fiercely leftist past. The article describes a tour of Manchester in the company of local radical historian Jonathan Schofield. There's no doubt where Schofield's sympathies lie. For instance, he's reverential about a table in the cloistered Cheetham's Library. Parts of the Communist Manifesto were written right here. Marx would sit on one side of the table and Engels on the other. Whenever I bring people from the Chinese consulate here and get out the old books that Marx and Engels touched, they weep. I suppose communism did cause a great deal of tears, what with one thing or another, in the gulags and the killing fields in Berlin and Budapest and the rice fields of China. And if communism began in Manchester, then maybe Morrissey was right. Manchester has so much to answer for. But is that fair? When Manchester and Mancunian citizens had these bold new ideas, they were the underdog, not the tyrant. Maybe another Smith's line from This Charming Man makes more sense here, one borrowed from Peter Schaffer's Sleuth. Manchester has always been a jumped-up pantry boy who never knew his place. Historian Asa Briggs remarked, "If Engels had lived not in Manchester, but in Birmingham, his conception of class and his theories of the role of class in history might have been very different. The fact that Manchester was taken to be the symbol of the age in the 1840s was of central political importance in modern world history." Schofield is even more direct. "Without Manchester, there would have been no Soviet Union. The history of the 20th century would have been very different." At the beginning of the 19th century, Manchester was on its way at breakneck speed to becoming the world's first major industrial city. Its wealth came from cotton and from the crushing labour and the desperate hardship endured by the city's workers. De Tocqueville put it succinctly when he said, "From this filthy sewer, pure gold flows." It had booming factories, grand hotels and fine parks. It also had 300 brothels and 700 prostitutes. So much for the good old days. They called it Cottonopolis, a behemoth of wealth and power and prestige built around city centre slums like Little Ireland. An excellent road system meant that the liberal factory owners could get in and out of the city without seeing the degradation suffered by their workers, and thus pronounced that they were doing famously before sleeping easy at night on feather beds in Cheshire or in the rolling hills of the Pennines. Dickens knew this. In hard times, his factory owners live on the moor in the fictitious town of Stone Lodge, where they can escape the smoke and the soot and the sewers of Coketown. Coketown was Manchester. The People's History Museum, located in an old pump house behind another putative apartment block, prides itself on being the only museum dedicated to the working people of Britain and the story of how they organised to change society, improving life for future generations. I like this museum a lot. The chap on the door looked like he might have been a former bus driver struggling manfully with the new demands of customer service, bless him. Perhaps mindful that the class struggle and dialectical materialism are not as immediately attractive to an 8-year-old as, say, a Stegosaurus or a Saturn V rocket, every effort has been made to make the museum all singing and dancing. You can have fun making your own badge or shop at a 1930s co-op. I think they should take this a lot further. They could have some games, for instance, commemorating the miners' strike. Hey, kids, can you get your flying pickets down the M62 from Lee Colliery to Orgreave without being stopped by the uniformed bully boys of the capitalist state? Or maybe a coconut shy, where you can win a goldfish for hitting Oswald Mosley or Norman Lamont. A little way away, in Salford Crescent, opposite the Peel Park campus of the university, a handsome former nurse's home houses the Working Class Movement Library, set up in the 50s by two voracious book collectors and activists called Eddie and Ruth Froe. If you want to know how the industrial north, and particularly Manchester and Salford, shaped modern Britain, then pop in. A year's subs are only a fiver, there's always a cup of tea on offer, and as well as a staggering book collection including a first edition of Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, you can see the flyer actually signed by Henry Hunt, announcing the meeting which led to the Peterloo Massacre. I'm on my way across town to the site of that very incident, the most significant and emotionally charged spot in Manchester's political history. I take a meandering route by the Palace Hotel and the Corner House, where in the 80s you couldn't get in unless you had a black zip up top, a copy of Marxism Today and a packet of Gitane, past the afternoon special brew drinkers on Oxford Road, and avoiding the temptation to double back into the Lassagowry for a quick one, down towards Deansgate via Peter Street. Eventually, I find the spot I'm looking for. In the warm afternoon sunshine, it doesn't look particularly horrifying or grisly. A sunny slice of piazza between the GMEX Centre and the new Convention Centre. The steps are crowded with delegates in name tags, puffing on intercession fags, sipping smoothies, picking up their messages, utterly oblivious to the bloody legacy of the site where they stand. Britain's Tiananmen Square. Peterloo. What happened here on the 16th of August 1819 should perhaps remind we English, maybe next time we're bombing a television station in Belgrade or a hospital in Iraq, of how sordid and uncivilised our own past can be. Not millennia back either, not in the age of the Celts or the Picts running around in those pelts and woad, but a few short generations ago. On my mum's side, I come from a line of Lancastrian weavers, so it's not unthinkable that my great-great-granddad, or some of his mates, might have been murdered here by British soldiers on a summer's afternoon in Manchester. A crowd of around 80,000 from across Lancashire had come to hear the rousing orator Henry Hunt and others speak. It was a time of desperate poverty and of growing radicalism, and the meeting was called to espouse various popular causes, universal suffrage, secret ballots, an end to unfair legislation. Henry Hunt, fearing that the magistrates would look for an excuse to overreact, asked people to come armed with no other weapon but that of a self-approving conscience, determined not to be irritated or excited. Everyone really expected a peaceful meeting, though, and many turned up wearing their Sunday clothes. However, at 1:31 p.m, the magistrates decided to stop the meeting and gave orders for the arrest of the leaders. Captain Joseph Nadin, Deputy Constable of Manchester, sent for the Manchester and Salford Yeomanry. These were a volunteer force, largely comprising businessmen and landowners, unlikely to be sympathetic to the rally's ideals. 60 yeomanry cavalrymen, possibly drunk, entered the field brandishing their sabres and charged towards the cart that served as the speaker's stand. When some demonstrators tried to stop them by linking their hands, they set about them viciously with their sabres. The yeomanry then began to strike down the flags and the banners of the crowd with their sabres until the hussars arrived, who cleared the field in minutes and pacified them. 11 people were killed then and there, including a woman and a child that another woman was carrying. About 400 were injured, 100 of them women, many of whom were trampled by horses. One man had his nose severed. Others were carried from the field, bleeding from numerous sabre cuts. 5 died later of their injuries. Many participants on both sides had fought at Waterloo, including one of the dead. This led James Rowe of the Manchester Observer to describe the events with bitter humour as the Peterloo Massacre. He was later arrested for having the temerity to report the events, another echo of Tiananmen. But there were many journalists present, and the events immediately found their way into the press. Shelley wrote the impassioned and angry poem The Mask of Anarchy as a response. Although there was widespread outrage, the government of the day supported the action of the army and the magistrates. The Home Secretary, Lord Sidmouth, even congratulated the murderers on their work. By the end of the year, he'd introduced legislation to suppress radical meetings and publications. But Peterloo had woken something in the nation as a whole, and the North in particular. The widespread public anger at the massacre swelled the support of the reform movement, from which the Chartists would eventually emerge. Red with blood that day, some say Manchester and the North has been red ever since. My theory is that the North has never really trusted Westminster, King or country since. Historian A.J.P. Taylor was right on the money when he said, Manchester cares no more for the royal family or the landed gentry than Venice did for the Pope or the Italian aristocracy. It is the only place in England which escapes our characteristic vice of snobbery. Let's hear it for Manchester then, the Red Venice of the North. A.J.P. Taylor also said, Manchester has everything but good looks. This used to be a common refrain. In the late 80s, the author Charles Jennings called it belligerently ugly in his cheerless anti-Northern polemic, Up North. Even proudly Northern writer Hunter Davies described it in 2000 as a building site full of gaping holes, claiming St. Anne's Square is the only attractive part of town. I like Hunter Davies, but I have to disagree here. Building sites don't stay building sites forever. Like caterpillars, they emerge from their cocoons of steel and wire, as butterflies, hopefully. This one certainly did, I think, as I stand on the walkway over the Manchester Ship Canal and gaze at Salford Quays. Salford isn't really Manchester. It's a separate city. To reach it, you go west, young man, across the Irwell, the river the colour of lead, immortalised by Sheila Delaney in A Taste of Honey, and Morrissey in The Smiths This Night Has Opened My Eyes. Manchester sees itself as a cool, classless, cosmopolitan, 24-hour party capital with style. But it has its own class divisions too, even its own north-south divide. The south has better wages, bigger houses, posher suburbs, smarter eateries, while North Manchester has the poverty, the sink estates and the appalling health statistics. But the biggest divide in town lies across the Irwell. All of Britain and great swathes of the world know Salford, its streets and chimneys and two up, two downs. They gaze on it in their millions, night after night, with an omnibus edition at weekends. In the early 1960s, a young man from Salford called Tony Warren wrote a drama about the lives and loves and trials of working class folk based on the people and places he'd grown up with. He called the town Weatherfield, and he called his drama Florizel Street. Then a Granada producer said that Florizel sounded like a disinfectant, and the name Coronation Street was chosen. At first, the show was dismissed by London critics as yet another piece of tiresome kitchen sink drama from the desolate north. Ken Irwin of the Daily Mirror opined, "The programme is doomed from the outset with its dreary signature tune and grim scene of terraced houses and smoking chimneys." Like Decca Records' rejection of the Beatles on the grounds that groups of guitars are on the way out, this must rank as one of the most myopic assessments in the chequered history of criticism. Corey went on to become one of the best-loved and most iconic television programmes ever. for many years, until telly became an orgiastic riot of multi-channel madness. The most expensive advertising slot on British TV was at 7:45 on Mondays and Wednesdays, smack in the middle of Coronation Street. There's quite a bit of smack in the middle of Coronation Street now. And kidnappings, internet child abuse, sex changes, all the usual stuff of Salford life, or so the producers must think. Professor Michael Harlow of Salford University remarked, "If we could remove Coronation Street from the TV, I would cheer. It does more bad for the reputation of Salford than anything else. It's a completely romanticised picture, and wrong. If people really want to know what it was like to live in Salford slums in the 1930s, they should go down to the Lowry and look at the pictures." And that's what I've come to do. With all due respect to Delaney, Warren, Graham Nash, Emmeline Pankhurst, Walter Greenwood, Albert Finney, Sir Peter Maxwell Davies, John Cooper Clarke, Alistair Cook, Christopher Eccleston, and all the rest, Lawrence Stephen Lowry is the most famous son of Salford. When Hunter Davies came here, the Lowry may have been just a building site, but these days it's one of the gems of the breathtaking Salford Quays development, and a far finer and more fitting tribute to that eminent son than that bloody song from Brian and Michael. Let's nail this canard immediately. L.S. Lowry never painted any flipping matchstock men or matchstock cats and dogs. He painted beautiful, detailed, childlike, haunting evocations of the streets, architecture and people around him. In fairness to Brian and Michael, whose tribute song made number one in 1978, that wouldn't have made a snappy song title. And yes, their song does mention Ancoats, and the St. Winifred's School Choir do sing "The Big Ship Sails on the Alley Alley O" in a nod to the film of Delaney's A Taste of Honey. But surely this gormless ditty has contributed to a hackneyed stereotype of the North. I've lost count of the number of Southrons who've asked me, chuckling, what sparking clogs means, and have I ever done it? Worse, it's an undervaluing of Lowry's unique talent. The Lowry Centre is a much better and hopefully more lasting monument to LS. It cost £94 million, just under a third of which came from the National Lottery. Next time you despair at the lines of shabby, defeated people in Asda blowing money they don't have on a 1 in 14 million chance of freedom, remember the Lowry and think, well, it's not all wasted. The dedicated galleries are on the north-facing side of the building to prevent damage from the sun, but the light streams in from the promenade windows, even from an opaque March sky. Salford began collecting Lowry's works in 1930 and has more than 350. What I love about the permanent exhibitions is that the full range of Lowry's work is on show, not just the trademark and wonderful industrial townscapes, but wistful, eerie portraits and sketches. My personal favourites are his seascapes, an obsession which he returned to again and again, vast, empty canvases of remote horizons where sea and sky intermingle at the edge of the world. I find them as stately and spiritual as the most monumental Rothkos. An old art teacher of mine, Mrs. Taylor, knew Lowry a little, and once, accompanied by a friend's little girl, went to see him when he was an old man, but still working in his studio and completing just such a seascape. Lowry asked the child if she liked it. She replied, "It's too empty. It needs a seagull." "Put one in then," said Lowry, amused, and handed her a brush. Horrified, Mrs. Taylor went to stop the child, but Lowry insisted, and the little girl put a tiny, stylized child seagull, like a flattened McDonald's M, in the corner of the sky, where, according to Mrs. Taylor, it remains to this day. I love that story. Some critics think there's a wry irony in the fact that a withdrawn loner, he died a virgin, it's assumed, who inhabited a dark cave of the imagination, as one put it, should be celebrated in the shining, futuristic creation of the Lowry Centre. I like to think of him as a genial old boy who would let a little girl paint a seagull on a canvas that he must have known was worth a fortune. That playfulness in him would approve of the fact that the Lowry rings daily now to the sound of kids doing workshops, going to and from pantomimes and concerts, pointing at his paintings and maybe thinking, "I draw like that." Whatever you feel about the Lowry Centre, the Lowry Hotel does seem to come wreathed in irony. A fabulous, opulent, watering hole and five-star hotel named after a man who painted matchstock kids sparking clogs or huddled factory workers shuffling and scampering to their shift. If you arrive, though, as I did, in the most biblical hailstorm even rainy Manchester can muster, It's an irony you can get to enjoy as the top-hatted, smoothly professional doorman opens your car door, shelters you with an umbrella and guides you into the airy, ultra-modern foyer before disappearing with your keys to valet park you somewhere snug. The Lonely Planet guide to this infuriating, invigorating powerhouse of a city says, Manchester is looking up. Gone are the Dickensian days of grinding poverty. Gone, too, the gloom and doom of the 1980s indie punk scene and its Joy Division pessimism. Over the last 15 years, the city has developed a champagne for breakfast insouciance and an almost giddy attitude towards fun.